ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing a tech industry analyst who helped shape the dot-com revolution, Jerry Mikulski. We're going to be talking about mass market capitalism and how, according to Jerry, it's being replaced by a relationship economy. Jerry, thank you so much for joining us today.
You've been called a software seer by Newsweek, which is a pretty awesome moniker. And can you... Who wouldn't like to be called that? I mean, really. And can you give the audience just a little bit of background so they understand the different views and approaches that you bring together?
So sure.
Why that? Why were you called the software seer?
I spent a dozen years as a tech industry analyst. So not a Wall Street analyst. I don't know how to analyze an income statement or a balance sheet, even though I took an advanced accounting course for reasons I don't even understand now, but really a trends analyst. And it turned out that the intersection of humans and technology is something I really cared a lot about, and mix in business. So during that time, I was reporting on computer software, all that kind of stuff, and I was on duty when the internet showed up. Now, the internet had been bubbling undercover for a long time as a military research network. But I just posted last night a speech I gave in 1991 at Lotus Development Corporation, where I don't say the word internet until about an hour and 24 minutes into an hour and a half long session, because we had all thought it would never open up. And yet everything sort of changes with that. So I was not only kind of on duty when the internet shows up, but I helped shape some of that conversation. I helped focus people on things like online community and instant messaging. I wrote articles about what eventually got called blogs and wikis and things of that nature. And then along the way, I realized I didn't like the word consumer. And I estimate that in that dozen years, I probably heard 4,000 pitches from startups and a few established companies. And everybody throws around the word consumer. And I started raising it in these meetings. In the briefings, I'd say, well, I don't really like that word. What about it? And half the people would say, don't worry about it. It's just a term of art in the ad business. And then the other half would say, you know, it really bothers me too. And the smartest thing I've done is pay attention to that word for the last 20 years. And that word handed me a thesis. I basically kept pushing on it, and it turned into this big thesis that we're entering a relationship economy, that treating people as mere consumers is stupid and short-sighted, that we're humans and that we have full lives, and this leads to a whole bunch of inventiveness on what you might sell me. It leads to a bunch of commercial things as well as rehumanizing capitalism in a way. So a big piece of what I bring is a history as a tech industry analyst, but then there's this whole other thread that I'm way too curious about way too many things, and I started realizing that my curiosities folded back into the main thesis and were crystallizing down to something that was really about trust. So I'm sort of a champion for humans and care a lot about trust, a topic I'm exploring heavily right now.
Totally set up my next few questions. It's perfect.
Love that.
You have the thesis about the consumer mass market capitalism failing and being replaced by this relationship economy. And can you explain what that actually means in a sort of practical way for media and entertainment companies?
Like, very easily, and maybe not pleasantly. The internet is an example of this other world of a relationship economy, because the internet sort of was born out of a bunch of engineers who didn't have as their mandate something to build the advanced intelligent network that the phone companies were trying to build, or some sophisticated cable network that other players might have been building. Instead, they were trying to build something that would just move bits from A to B. And what happens when the internet goes public is that, I don't know if you've read Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut, but he postulates a substance called Ice-9 that some researcher invented and gave to his kids. Ice-9, wherever it touches water, turns everything into ice. And the internet was that for communication networks. Basically, what the phone companies thought they were going to do was hijacked entirely by the internet. Cable companies, not so much. But this suddenly, this network that had peering arrangements and protocols that anybody could mess with and a bunch of other open things was taking over their world. Same thing goes for open source software. There's a tremendous number of businesses built on open source software now. So all of those things are examples of this thing I call the relationship economy. And whether it's going to replace or repair capitalism, I'm not sure. And that gets into fun philosophical kind of questions that we don't need to spend time on here. But what I discovered was that open source software and the internet have principles in common with microfinance and unschooling and traffic calming and animal gentling and stuff that is so far afield you'd be like, no, no way. And yet, it is. And it all has to do with the fact that years ago, somehow, we lost faith in humans. And part of it was we mechanized everything and everything became big and mass market. And what we don't realize is that humans and society and relationships and community, those things actually matter and meaning matters, especially when the systems involve humans, because otherwise they find like there's no purpose in life. And so what's happening right now in every sector is that these movements are already well underway. I'm not trying to postulate that if only everybody believed the way I believe, all things would be better, which I've read a bunch of books that go like that. What I'm saying is this movement is already in process, but it looks inoffensive. It looks like the weeds in the sidewalk. In fact, it's the thing that's going to be our next generation, I think.
Right, right. The sort of the stealthy disruption.
Well, suddenly you look back and it's like, oh my God, it's all different now. Why didn't I notice when the change happened?
Well, sure. I mean, it's the quote about, you know, you look backwards and the dots, you can connect them. But if you can't connect them looking forward, what good is it for you in terms of planning? Is part of this is this relationship economy and all of that is this essentially the result of decentralization of the means of content production and delivery? Is that really what's going on?
Yeah, there's sort of it's a techno-social thing that's going on. So part of it is technology, part of it is society. On technology, we now have an extremely democratic kind of technology between the smartphone, the computer, and the inner tubes. All of a sudden, anybody can go out and, you know, build a nuclear weapon or create a 3D design studio or shoot the next movie or what have you. But then socially, what happened was when we lost faith in humans and built systems to make them do stuff like learn, our educational system, or cross the street safely, our traffic system, we took away their agency. We treated them as mere consumers, which means your job is to consume. Your job is to choose between the Cheerios and the Cocoa Puffs, not to ask me how I made the Cheerios, not to make Cheerios yourself, not to share them with your neighbor. All that stuff breaks our business model because we need to sell a lot of Cheerios, because if we don't, the economy craters, and that's bad for everybody.
But to play devil's advocate, just so...
Please.
So IP is decentralized, and everybody can develop it, and they can put it up there. But if discovery is still centralized or controlled, because it isn't a problem of content, it's a problem of discovering the content, really. The more there is, how do you filter through it? How do you know what's useful, what's not useful? And if that's still centralized, if these curators, if these giant media companies go from being the creators and the producers to the curators, and certainly if they start controlling the pipes and who gets priority, doesn't matter.
Well, I would say that curation has been blown wide open, that it used to be that if you wanted to publish a book, you had to convince an editor at one of the big publishing houses, Macmillan, Penguin, whoever, you had to talk them into publishing your book.
Right.
And if you wanted to create a TV show, you had to convince one of the networks to carry it and get a lot of money. And nowadays, you know, between web shows and whatnot, we've all seen that stuff goes viral and it was made for $200 or something and it takes over. Now, all of that is coexisting in a world of Gangnam Style and Beyonce. So it's all mingled together. The curators, curiously, are not the big companies that carry that do the pipes, because I just moved my mom, plugged her into a new Comcast connection, and there's 500 channels of absolutely nothing to watch. I do not see any curation. I see a market, and I see a bunch of stuff, and I see that anything that's reasonably good is going to be extra cost. It's like pay-per-view for this and that, it's add-ons. And then I turn around and I look at YouTube, and I do a search, and stuff comes up that's unbelievable. And I can wander endlessly, and the thing is free. How do you compete with that? So partly what's happening too is that the recommendations, the curation I follow most is my buddy saying, hey, did you see this thing? Did you read this book? I just got off hosting a two-hour call, and four book titles came up, right? And in one documentary. And it's like, I'm going to remember those and I'm going to go look at those before I'm going to look at the five emails I get every day from Amazon and everybody else saying, hey, here's titles we think you'll like.
You know, with your algorithm based upon the things you've watched.
Your Prime membership includes $1.99 for all of these books. And I'm not interested in a single one of them. I'm not even interested in looking at the list. Right now, every now and then, I get into a corner on Amazon, particularly because they're pretty good at this, where there's a list of books underneath that, in fact, are actually related to what I'm thinking about and the way my brain is headed, which is very different from these are sort of like the thing you just looked at. That's hard to do. And people are really good at it. Now, some of those people bubble up and become stars and become major mass media. It's already like 10 years ago that some of the bloggers became press.
Right.
And they were just bloggers, and all of a sudden they're accredited journalists, right? How'd that happen? Well, that's that, you know, the interface, the liminal zone between this grassrootsy remix culture up from the bottom media and major media.
Well, right. And there's where sort of trust and authenticity comes in. I know there have been any number of surveys that say that people respond just as you do, first to recommendations from people they actually know, their friends. And then secondly, recommendations from real strangers, like a Yelp review, then an advertisement or a celebrity endorsement. Those are the least convincing to the general public because they don't feel authentic to them. And the trust seems to be broken. Is that something that big companies can recover? Can they co-opt? Can they achieve that? Is that possible?
Totally. It's just that it's not in their frame of mind to do so. There's a term called faux-thenticity.
Ah, I like that.
Yeah. Pine and Gilmore wrote a book titled Authenticity years ago, in which they talk about the perception of authenticity as being the goal, not actual authenticity. So I call that faux-thenticity. And it's possible, like people paid $200 to buy jeans that look like they've been really well worn, right?
Yes.
And that was done by artisans sitting somewhere being paid nothing and scraping away at the jeans or
artisans
putting stone.
Artisans is a kind way to put it. I don't know.
I know. I'm being sweet. And also throwing stones in the dryer or the washer so that, you know, you get this well-worn look. It's the attempt to find authenticity. So set that aside for a second. Just last night I was talking with a friend and I was reminiscing about an open letter I posted on my blog so many years ago that two blogs have since gone away and I've moved the letter and I realized I need to repost it. And it was an open letter to public relations. And I said, why don't you think instead about being known as public relationships? And instead of your job being protecting the corporate veneer and making sure that nothing besmirches it and getting rid of all objections, instead of that, your job is to tear open holes in the corporate veneer strategically to connect interesting and useful publics outside to humans inside. Mm. 10, 15 years ago, a guy who's sort of a celebrity now, Robert Scoble, was a Microsoft employee, and he did a genius thing. He picked up a video camera before the days when we were all carrying HD cameras in our pockets. He picked up a video camera and he walked around to the developers at Microsoft, put a camera on them and their screen and said, tell me of this thing that you're building. And he humanized, it was called Channel 9, and he humanized Microsoft in a way that Wagner Edstrom, the PR company that was designed for Microsoft, they were sort of at birth because related to the founders, had not been able to move the needle on at all. And suddenly Microsoft wasn't the Borg, they had humans inside. That kind of thing. He tore open a little hole with simple technology that allowed us to see that there were humans inside. So really big carriers and companies can do this too. The problem is there's a lot of skeletons in the closet. They're busy doing a lot of things to preserve the business model that everybody else doesn't like so much. And they fear that if you start poking, you know, if you start tearing open holes, the screaming is going to come in.
Right, right. Well, related to trust is privacy.
Yes.
And I think that that's also certainly an issue of our time and going to be more of an issue. One of the things I find very interesting is my 15-year-old is much more careful about what he posts, what he doesn't post. He lurks and he watches, but he's very savvy about it in a way that maybe I'm not. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a grown up, so there are certain things I'm not worried about, but he really manages it, you know? And I think and is aware of it, and it's a turnoff if he discovers that various things are being monitored. He doesn't like it. And certainly Pokemon Go, we had a very lively discussion around, well, they're just all the data and what they're collecting. And it was very much part of his thinking. And do you notice anything about privacy and how that feeds into this relationship economy?
Any number of things. The most succinct thing I can offer is a slide that I use more often than not when I give talks these days. And the slide has three words on it. It says stalk or serve.
Aha.
And we are now hip deep, if not nostril deep, in the stalker economy. And Al Gore and a couple other people have called it that publicly. If you Google stalker economy, you'll find them. And basically what's happening is everybody is leaving juicy little data trails everywhere. The big companies like Facebook are busy selling off our profiles and our actions. Some of these players are more trustworthy than others because they make certain pledges. And like, for example, I trust Google much more than I trust Facebook. Mm-hmm. But we're all in there. And there's a few refuseniks, but basically all our data is in there. And companies have a choice. And I think it's a moral choice that they don't realize they're making right now by default on the stock side. And they could use the same data to serve us better. Like, I love it when I go back to Amazon and it's one click to buy stuff and it shows up and, you know, at the doorstep the next day. I love it when they know what else I've bought. I don't trust them an awful lot, but they do okay with it. But you could serve me really well, or you could be busy doing what your 15-year-old hates, which is surveilling me, sweeping up all this stuff, and then unconsciously trying to make me buy more crap I don't need.
Why is it if we are all... forgive the use of the word consumers or mm-hmm. people. We all know how we feel about it. Why then, when we put on our corporate hats, do we abandon what we know to be the case? I mean, you know, it's as if we're designing our services for this worker population over to the left that I am not a part of. You know,
right.
It doesn't make sense. So we are who we are serving, and certainly in entertainment, that's the case. So how do we miss it? Why are we missing it?
I love this question. There's a lot of good reasons, and I'm not sure I'm going to remember all of them that just came up in my head to tell you. One of them is that 40s, 50s, 60s, we mandated that everybody set aside their personality and come into work as a robot employer, manager, whatever. That you were not permitted to talk about moral issues or how you felt or whatever, you know. And that has completely changed now. Also, questions like meaning, purpose, you know, why is this company, why do we exist? Is it just to sell more sugar water, or what are we doing? That was a verboten question inside the company as well, until really just recently. But also, all of this grew up really quickly and became a mechanism that a lot of people made a lot of money from. If you look at the consumer mass marketing ecosystem, there are layers upon layers of production houses, advertisers, remarketers, indies in the radio system who make money off the radio stations, who make money off the record labels. Now, the artists aren't getting much money at all. But there's all sorts of cash flows going on inside the industry that nobody really wants to touch. You don't want to kill the golden goose. The golden goose is busy laying lots of eggs. You don't do that.
Well,
right?
except you're not feeding, you know, it all goes away if the artist goes away. And yet
Correct.
Nobody's feeding the artist. I mean, in fact, look at Facebook. If it weren't for everybody participating and handing over their micro content, why would anybody be there?
But arguably, it's still a mega hits business for the big players. You need a couple Beyoncés and a couple Jay-Z's, as long as they don't wake up the way a few artists have and said, no, I own my own masters, you know, Prince and a couple others that don't kind of play with the industry nice. But you get a couple mega hits and they move a lot of things. You know, Taylor Swift was a third or more of the record industry a couple years ago, of the whole industry.
Wow.
The entire industry. It's astonishing how big that is. That if you can keep producing those, that lulls you into a sense that this business might still be around for a really long time in its current state. Right?
Right.
There's one thing I wanted to bring back also to your last question of why don't we see this? Why don't we do it? There's a psychological distance involved. And if you want to go deeper into this, I recommend a book of all titles. It's titled On Killing, by a retired Army colonel named David Grossman, who studied debriefings of military personnel after combat. And he talks about distance. He says, if I'm killing somebody, there's a physical distance, there's a mechanical distance, there's a psychological distance and a couple other things he talks about. And when I say that the language of advertising is the language of a military campaign, that marries these two ideas right together really sweetly, because when I'm in the lab creating the next ad to go send flights of messages against target demographics to create market penetration, I have psychological distance. It's just consumers out there. Consumer is a distancing word. It's not me.
Right.
Right.
Well, it's interesting. So moving from these managed, like Facebook, Instagram, these things, we've actually seen lately reports have shown engagement in Facebook and Instagram are declining and participation in messaging programs are going up. And in some ways, I think it's interesting because it seems like that's something that all the marketers can't get in quite yet. They'd like to, but they haven't yet. Can they?
It's a little... Yeah, this whole thing is a little bit of an arms race with stages over time, right? There's an era where everybody learns how to text and starts texting. I remember living in Manhattan and hearing somebody saying, "I am me that," on a bus. And I'm like, oh, okay, so instant messaging is now mainstream. And just before that, I saw a URL printed on the side of a bus. Okay, that's mainstream. So now we're going through waves. And as soon as your parents and little brother showed up on Facebook, you were going somewhere else. But also, you left trails that weren't vanishing on Facebook, and somebody invents this thing called Snapchat that vanishes. Awesome, right? So you shift. And I think this will just keep happening. There's no undying loyalty here. Each of these entities, each of these platforms tries to build something that is sticky like Roach Motel, so that, you know, once all your photos are on Facebook and it's hard to get them out, you're going to have to stay on Facebook, right? Well, maybe you'll sacrifice that. At Google, there's something called the Data Liberation Front, which is a very cute bunch of Googlers whose job it is to make it easy for you to export all your data should you ever want to leave, right? That's why I trust Google more than I trust Facebook.
But these are
generational things, and they're just going to keep getting replaced. Facebook nuked Friendster, absolutely nuked them. The timing was perfect. Friendster was rising. Remember Friendster and MySpace?
Right.
For a little bright and shining moment, those were the social networks. And before them, Orkut and Six Degrees, and I can name another 20 that went before Facebook.
So
right?
What was it that made Facebook able to nuke them?
Multiple brilliant things, including timing. Including timing. All of a sudden, we were all kind of coming online, and we were all ready. We had tested a lot of these things out. We weren't yet exhausted of social networks. Like, if I told you that right now I've invented a new one, and would you join? You would roll your eyes at me, right?
Right.
You'd be like, yeah, right? The 21st that I've already joined? You wouldn't. But by that time, not everybody was on yet. And then they chose a really nice viral approach. First, it's Harvard only. Then it's Ivy League only. Then it's students only. Then it's all humanity, right? Then bring grandpa on board. And then in the era when Facebook was growing up, I've been pretty close to Twitter. Remember the Twitter fail whale? It was a little play on how Twitter would crash all the time. And Twitter would be unavailable for some period. And if you look at a screen of Twitter and you look at a screen of Facebook, Facebook is doing a whole lot more than Twitter ever does. Hmm. But Facebook never crashed.
Do you think, though, that they're, because Facebook is increasingly moving into the ad space, and they're even talking about experimenting with sound, so it's not even silent anymore, is that going to turn people off? And is that an opportunity for somebody else? Or are we just going to accept it? It will wash over us. Surfing our feed is what surfing channels used to be.
I think people try to avoid the ads and the stalking as much as they can. So they wiggle free, they go to other services, they go to mobile. On mobile, it's much harder to insert things without really being annoying. Hmm. So a lot of people are carrying their smartphones all the time. Boom, boom, boom. Thank you so much. So they'll go to territory where it's harder to be pursued like this. And then every large service that gets really successful winds up polluting itself with more and more ads. They have to keep turning the knob, partly because of the insane short-termist perspective of Wall Street. Right. It's like, hey, you had a fan. You just blew the doors off last quarter. That is so good. That is built into your stock price right now. What are you going to do for me in 3 months?
I've been reading about the fourth industrial revolution and sophisticated automation and data exchange and the potential really for significant and permanent underemployment. It's a little scary, really, what's coming down the pike. And after talking to some people about AI and where that's headed, it's knowledge workers who are going to get, you know, we're all like, oh, well, you know, those blue collar people. But it's it's the lawyers. AI will be able to write contracts, and you know, so
it already can in some cases. I mean, it can write news stories. It can write medical analyses of X-rays. It can, et cetera.
Right. I mean, and then the sports reporting is already largely AI. So what does that mean for society? And then drilling down, because of the people I'm trying to, you know, energize, what does it mean for entertainment? This new thing, this large population of underemployed people, what their economics are going to be like, and how does, what does it mean?
Yeah, and we've got a couple of minutes to cover this. This is something we could talk for a long time about. I'm on the side, there are people who argue that every time we've had a technological revolution, when we went from buggies with horses to cars, then we suddenly had to build roads, we had mechanics, we had gas stations, we had to make tires. It created its own new set of employment that was hard to predict, hard to foresee 20 years earlier. Got it. And then I have a friend who interviewed me many years ago about the future of paper, and you'd think paper would be going away. It turns out that at least back in the day, paper usage just kept going up because new uses kept showing up. In each of those previous revolutions, there was never a flesh-eating bacterium called software that was trying to eat everything. And that at almost no cost was able to eat everything. Then you asked, your last word was entertainment. What is the role of entertainment here? And I think that's a really touchy subject for me in particular, because I think we're being entertained to death. I think we've substituted engagement, and I don't mean customer or consumer engagement or employee engagement. I mean actual human engagement and civic stuff about how your kids are growing up and whether you're going to be able to stop the crime wave that's heading toward your neighborhood, and what do you do about the older people who seem to be that stuff, right? We've just serviced that out in some way. And there's a huge opportunity to actually help people solve those problems and to be part of the community and to be trusted that large companies don't even see as an opportunity because it isn't the present golden goose.
Right, right. Wow. How many years out are we from really having to confront these challenges in a real way?
Well, we had the Arab Spring, which is already a couple of years ago, and we had the Occupy movement, which is already a couple of years back, right? Both of those things were pretty big. Am I wrong?
Yeah, no, you're right.
And we also had the GFC, the global financial collapse, which was also a pretty big deal and came pretty close to actually causing much greater damage. I mean, it might have been that we couldn't have gone to the money wall and received, you know, gotten money out. That might have been a consequence of it, but wasn't. Something sudden like any of these could happen at a larger scale, any place, at any time. We're pretty well anesthetized, a word that's very hard to say. We're pretty well anesthetized as a society, so people don't go banging pots in the streets very much like they do in South America when you try to privatize their water, for example, in Bolivia. But we could get there pretty quickly.
All right, well, now I'm going to change gears because we are reaching the end of our time with you. Just some rapid fire words. First thing that comes to mind, Facebook.
Neighborhood.
Google.
Everything.
Snapchat.
Why?
Twitter.
Flow.
YouTube.
Wow.
Ad blockers.
Yep.
Art.
Where did it go?
AI.
The menace on the horizon.
VR.
Total skeptic.
And what are you watching for entertainment?
YouTube, a ton.
YouTube.
Also some Netflix. Loved House of Cards, loved Band of Brothers, you know, earlier things. That wasn't really Netflix.
And what excites you?
This possibly flipped future where we actually come back into a relationship.
Right. And lastly, what's up next for you? What's your next project?
A bunch of different things on the ground. I'm trying to do a lot of things around trust. I'd love to create a design practice called Design From Trust, not for, but from trust. I can explain it a lot more in different sorts of things, but Wikipedia is a really nice example. Every page on Wikipedia says edit.
Right.
That is a gesture of vulnerability on Wikipedia's part, because any idiot from the world can come and make a change to the encyclopedia of the world and hit save, right?
Right.
Well, it turns out that it's really easy to undo the bad ones, but this is a really nice way of recruiting participants.
Right.
So that is a form of design from trust, and there's many, many, many others in the world. I would like to make that a practice.
That's interesting. Interesting. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Well, we've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who've been indispensable to bringing this to life. As usual, first and foremost is the incomparable voice artist, my friend, Rob Naughton. Thanks, Rob.
A big thank you to our guest and new friend, Jerry Mikulski.
our production team over at Microfame Media. Thank you.
And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.